So my name is David Livingston. I am an independent researcher. I've been at it for 35 years now, approximately, studying the history of the occult. So I've written now 6 books, all dealing effectively with the same core idea, which is the survival of an occult tradition that began in Babylon in 6th century BC, later known as the Kabbalah. But also in its various transformations as the Western occult tradition. And I've been following that at different stages in our history. So from the earliest times to the French Revolution, its manifestation as Islamic terrorism, as modern day fascism, and most recently as Zionism.
Right, so I mean, many people think of the Kabbalah as some say, people like Madonna following this, and we've also got these other peculiar traits, like for example, Scientology, which is all about apparently mankind being put here by aliens. So, can you just take us through why it is and what it is that they believe? People like Madonna take this idea on, and I wonder if it's this is typical of the different brands of Kabbalah.
Well, so what Madonna is following is what I call pop Kabbalah. It's basically a Hollywood version of Kabbalah. It's packaged for celebrities to sort of market the Kabbalah light to the masses. So it's not the real, it's not the same Kabbalah that would be followed by, the architects of destruction that are the Machiavellians of our time. There's very little correlation. It's just a few sort of pseudo spiritual tidbits that are, thrown out there to try to attract some high profile people. Because if we
So,
want to
I mean,
understand the Kabbalah, we have to do something.
the idea seems to be that, if you can get celebrities that are into this stuff, this is a quite a good way to hook the general public, particularly teenagers, vulnerable teenagers, looking for their own celebrity superstar or role model. That actually, they may start seeking out this Kabbalah too.
Yeah, which it doesn't really work, and the Scientologists did the same thing, and even the fact that they've managed to recruit probably one of the biggest movie celebrities of our time, which is Tom Cruise, it's not attracting any more people to the so-called church, but that's what they're trying to do.
So
It's
there
the
is
more
this other version
that are
of
prostitutes.
Kabbalah. Yeah, there's this other version of Kabbalah. Can you just talk a bit about the what's below the surface then?
So below the surface, basically, there's important stages in the Kabbalah. So when people refer to, or scholars, academics refer to Kabbalah, what they really are referring to is what they call a mystical tradition that begins in the latter half of the 13th century. So late 1200s is when it makes its first appearance in southern France, and it has a later manifestation in the 1500s with Isaac Luria, which is called a new Kabbalah. But all these trends have their origin in older mystical traditions, and these can be traced back to the early centuries AD. So most of the pioneering work that was done in this subject was done by Gershom Scholem. There's a few others who've carried on more recently, principally Moshe Edel. And they are stuck with the same question. So what most there's a book called Sefer HaBahir, which appeared in, again, the late 1200s. And so even more recent scholarship like Moshe Edel, there's others like Nathaniel Deutsch, they are perplexed by how it could be that Gnostic ideas that had effectively been suppressed from Judaism for 1,000 years up until that point could suddenly reappear. And there's various theories to explain why. So first of all, what's the original Gnostic sources? So they emerged in the early centuries AD. And so this is where a lot of the focus of my work has been, because it's trying to, there's a lot of politics involved. So there's typically, there are attempts to try to explain overlaps and influences and avoid pointing the finger where it's obviously pointing. So what I'm trying to say is that there's a sort of confluence of doctrines that happens in what's called a Hellenistic age. So that's the period from of Roman rule, when the spread of Greek culture began with the conquest of Alexander. So you see that there's a number of mystical traditions that emerge at the time. There is Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, Gnosticism, and the ancient mysteries. And there is also what Gershom Scholem called Jewish Gnosticism. So there's a lot of interrelationships. And so it's why scholars refer to it as syncretism, because there's sort of a cross-pollination that happens. And there's a tendency to try to avoid what I think is the obvious conclusions, that they're not interrelated by some kind of accident, but it's because of how the sharing of those ideas is perceived. So basically what happens is that, first of all, you have to go back. So if we're going to be explaining the history of Zionism, we had to understand the history that we're experiencing today. So like the way I put my book in context is to say that, you know, most people are used to dealing with all kinds of political topics today as sort of, you know, the elements of the intellectual discussions of our time. So is democracy or liberalism and fascism and communism, capitalism and feminism, all the isms and schisms. But what's happening now in Israel should make people, it should help realize that all these are basically just distractions, and that the events, the true events, the true foundational events of our time are being spearheaded by people who basically are the original protagonists of the Bible. Effectively, the events that are happening right now are proving that, you know, the true hidden architects of our time are not Hindus, they're not Buddhists, right? They're not Taoists, they're not pagans. They are the inheritors of the a story of the Bible, the protagonist of the Bible. So
yeah, to interrupt you, but you've got different traditions, haven't you, in Judaism, very mm-hmm. different traditions, what not the least of which is this enormous separation between Jews, Orthodox Jews that follow this Babylonian Talmud, and yeah. those that follow the Jerusalem Talmud. So, you know, yeah. there are enormous great schisms, and I wonder if you could just explain this term Gnostic. We hear it a lot nowadays, people yeah. like the Gnostic warriors and things like this, but what does that term mean, and what about this, you know, massive difference in these Judaism traditions?
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I subtitled my book History of a Jewish Heresy. So but before I explain the divergence, I'd like to explain the background. So in the shortest summary I provide, basically the Abraham, after he stopped from sacrificing his child, God establishes a covenant with him, and it's a promise that his descendants will be a very large number will inherit the land of Israel/Palestine, which is henceforth known as the Promised Land. Several generations later, Joseph and his 12 sons, they enter Egypt, and then again several generations later, there are a large community of Israelites living in Egypt under oppression. Moses frees them, he brings them back to Palestine. When they are brought back there, which is basically the beginning of the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham, they are commanded to conquer the local inhabitants, who are Canaanites. Now, there's a side story there that we can come back to later. They are also told to not follow two things: do not intermarry them, and do not follow their religion. And of course, Moses receives the Ten Commandments. So the idea is that these early Israelites were chosen by God, that if they followed the Ten Commandments, they were promised that they would be rulers of the world. Effectively, they would be such shining examples that everybody would, you know, just naturally regard them as the rightful models for the rest of humanity. And they would have been. But instead, you know, their rebellion begins soon as they escaped Egypt, already worshiping the golden calf. When they return to Palestine and conquer Palestine, they start imitating the worship of the Canaanites, which involves the worship of a god Baal and his sister spouse Astarte. So the whole story of from the Exodus and the conquest of Palestine to the Babylonian captivity is a period of, depending on the estimates, about 1,000 years or so, is one of the constant rebellion of the Israelites against their religion that they were commanded to follow. So there's numerous prophets that are sent one after the next to try to reform them, and to try to reform them, to return to them to the true religion, and warning them of an impending conquest if they don't reform themselves. Solomon builds the Great Temple, which becomes the center of the Israelite cult at the time, but even it becomes completely polluted so that it becomes basically a pagan temple. There's a certain point, which is what I argue, that the Jews were indistinguishable from the rest of the Canaanite pagan population at the time, which is why when you read the ancient histories, they're described as Phoenicians, because the rest of the world didn't know that they were people with a separate tradition, because outwardly, likely physically, and in terms of their cult, they were indistinguishable. So what happens is that, according to the Bible, two prophecies are fulfilled. The first is when the Assyrians come, and I think it's 710. They come and they conquer the northern kingdom of Jerusalem, where the 10 of the 12 tribes lived, and they disperse them. And then from that point forward, they become lost. About a century later, and I think it's 596, 97, the Babylonians come. They conquer Jerusalem. They destroy the temple, and they carry the majority of the population to Babylon. So this is where I argue, I've been arguing since my earliest book, The History of the Dying God, is that it's at that point that you have, there were some who chose to, because what was supposed to happen is that punishment of the conquest of the captivity was supposed to be a wake-up call. It was supposed to make them realize that, you know, this was now a punishment for their failure to observe, to stay away from the dying God worship and to return to the Ten Commandments. But instead, they reinterpreted it so that this is where you see that the cult of the dying God now becomes a secret interpretation of a sort of early Zionism, where the God loves them despite their actions, and they are chosen nonetheless, and they can still expect their Messiah, and that eventually they will regain the right to inherit the promised land. So what happens then is...
Yeah, so sorry, David, but again, it's like what you're saying is that the Jewish leadership have kind of usurped this idea that they've got to stick to what God says, and they're saying, well, actually... we're just chosen whether God says so or not, you know, right. And they're kind of usurping that promise in a way. They're right. Saying, well, you know, let's just kind of ignore God's side of the promise. We're going to do what we want and he'll still be with us.
Yes. So that's effectively, so that's sort of the beginnings of the heresy, and that's where it diverges. Right. So and that's the core of the problem. So what happens basically is that these early Israelites who had incorporated the worship of the dying god, and they added to it astrology and numerology and elements of alchemy. And so when the Persians came in 538 and released them from captivity, they spread to various parts of the world. So many of them returned to Israel, where they rebuilt the second temple. Many of them ended up in Egypt, and some of them in Greece. In Greece, that's where they contributed to Greek philosophy. And in Egypt, that's where they contributed to Hermeticism. Because within Judaism, in the land of Israel, they basically emerged as the Essenes. So Essenes were a pretty small sect of Judaism, a fairly fringe sect, so they didn't definitely represent the body of the Jewish community. But according to occult tradition, that's where it all began. And in fact, this is where Gershom Scholem identifies the earliest elements of what later became known as Kabbalah to be found amongst the Essenes. And so that's both where we get the history of Zionism. So basically what happens at that point is that, first of all, a second punishment comes with the conquest of Jerusalem in 70 AD by the Romans, and that's the beginning of the exile. So basically the Jews were without land from that point until 1948. And so, but it's in that period that you get the development of the Talmud and effectively what's Orthodox Judaism. So where there's a lot of confusion today is that when a lot of researchers look at the sort of the offensive practices of certain Jewish elements, they assume that it could be traced to the Jewish religion. So you're going to find a lot of things in the Talmud that you might severely disagree with, but you'll find those in any scriptures. You'll find them in Islam as well too. All those elements need to be properly interpreted by somebody who's knowledgeable on the subject. You might still disagree with it, but the reality is that that is what Orthodox Judaism consists of. But now you've got a separate element, which is the Kabbalistic element, and that is a side and fringe element, which is was not at the core of Jewish tradition. And like I said, Gershom Scholem called it Jewish Gnosticism, because it was effectively just another branch of the kind of Gnosticism that infected Christianity. And the reason why it's so uncomfortable is because Gnosticism is well known that it's Luciferian. So it basically, it's based on the Bible, except that they regard God to be an oppressor and Satan to be a liberator. And what I've been trying to show in my books is that Gnosticism not only didn't belong just to Christianity, it began amongst early Gnostic Jews, as Gershom Scholem said, but it was also the core belief system of these other cults of Neoplatonism and Hermeticism. And I believe that all these traditions were manifestations of a single core tradition, which would have been sort of like the early Kabbalah. Just like in our day, you find all various kinds of manifestations of occultism, but at the core, the ideas are the same. So that's where this bifurcation begins. And so this is how, you know, the larger, vast majority of the Jewish community were mostly focused on the following of the Talmud. And like you mentioned, there might be some variations, but on the whole. And then you've had this slow growth of the influence of Kabbalah, and that really begins its influence with the era of the Crusades. So this is where we can get into more of the meat of my recent book. I don't know if you've got a question at this point before I move on, because there's a couple of directions.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, the Crusades have got some kind of spooky coincidences with what's been happening really since the First World War and the Second World War and the creation of the State of Israel. It's like, yeah, you know, in the medieval Crusades, which were obviously led by the Vatican, which has its own question marks about the motives there. Yeah. Although, of course, you know, ordinary Catholics do tend to be very sort of very decent, faithful people. You'll find that the top of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, I mean, has spent quite a lot of its time, certainly in the early years, just trying to destroy the Orthodox Church rather than, you know, put forward, you know, real, genuine Christian values. So I just wonder what you make of this comparison between, I don't want to jump you too far forward, but between the mission of the Templars and the Vatican during the Crusades, and, you know, the resurgence of, in fact, the great successes of Saladin and the Islamic leaders in that time and today.
Yeah, so the thing is that, you know, the Catholic Church has gone through a lot of transformation. And I've had this is part of the discussion I've been having recently, and I also treat in Ordo Apcal, is the influence, the infiltration of the Frankists into the Catholic Church. So what I believe has happened is that because you can, it coincides with the growth of what they call Mariology, so the veneration of Mary. And that begins pretty much around the time soon after the, like I said, the infiltration of the Frankists in the Catholic Church. And there was a plot, which is well known, of the Carbonari to eventually install a pope of their own. And so, you know, according to their own words, they believe because there was also the attempt to make Cardinal Rampolla, a member of the OTO, into pope as well, which didn't succeed. But they believe they finally succeeded Vatican II. So there's a whole modern trend of the hijacking of the Catholic Church, which I think we have to distinguish from the period that went before. So that's not to say that, you know, there's various, I want to be careful of the words I use, because I would say, you know, some modifications of the core doctrine, the core teachings of Jesus that happened even at the earliest stages of Christianity, because it already appropriated elements of dying God worship. But, you know, that's not to say that they had this like occult mission as a whole from the beginning. When you look at the Templars, they were a Luciferian order that effectively ended up being at war with the Catholic Church. But where this is the point, in fact, let me start with this is where I think is really a curious fact that, so this is where I'm going to show how it sort of stems back to the Crusades, is because a central character in my recent book is Richard Wagner, the German composer. He heavily influenced two people, and one of them is Adolf Hitler, which is well known, and the other one is Theodor Herzl. I'd like to read a comment that he wrote. Okay, so he begins by referring to he mentions this in the Judenstadt, and he starts by referring to Heinrich Heine. Heinrich Heine was a very famous German poet, also a Frankist. So he begins by saying, Heine tells us that he heard the flapping of an eagle's wings above his head when he wrote certain verses. I too believe that I heard such a fluttering of wings while I wrote that book. I worked on it every day to the point of utter exhaustion. My only recreation was listening to Wagner's music in the evening, particularly to Tannhäuser, an opera which I attended as often as it was produced. Only on the evenings when there was no opera did I have any doubts as to the truth of my ideas. So this is really peculiar, because this is the same opera that heavily influenced Herzl, and it's an opera. So I'm at a loss to try to explain how this opera could possibly have influenced Herzl and the Zionist cause, because, and I'll explain to you what the basis of the opera is. So the opera is referring to a recreation of a contest, a song contest called the Wartburgkrieg, that took place, I guess it would have been the 1300s. In Germany, in Thuringia. It was organized by Hermann I of Thuringia. And in the contest was Wolfram von Eschenbach, who was the author of the Percival, the story of the Night Swan. So the Night Swan is basically, it's a grail story of a man who comes in a sort of some kind of raft, which is pulled by swans. So he arrives miraculously in this place, and he falls in love with this maiden, and he is forced to depart, but he leaves behind a son, and that son is Godfrey of Bouillon, who's the leader of the First Crusade. And the belief that Godfrey was a descendant of this Night Swan was quite widespread, and so effectively it's understood that this, you know, quote-unquote Night Swan was effectively some kind of spirit being or demon or something of the sort. So that's what they're suggesting. So now I got to come back to another point, is that there's a great book, I can't remember her full name, her last name is Abu Lugaj. She wrote a book called Before European Hegemony, I think is what the title is. And she shows how the birth of modern European civilization really takes place in the county of Champagne in France after the Crusades, when the Crusaders basically brought the elements of industry that they had discovered in the Middle East and began to develop them in Champagne, and sort of, you know, developed sort of an early capitalism and an evolution of wealth that eventually gave birth to European hegemony. So it's important because this Champagne was ruled over by the House of Champagne, and at the time, Hugh of Champagne, who was one of the founders of the Templars. And so Champagne, the city of Troyes in France, which was in Champagne, probably the center, I guess, of the Champagne region. And there is where resided Rashi. And Rashi is one of the most famous Jewish scholars of medieval times. And he's also recognized as probably being the first person to have expressed Zionist views, because he's the first to have suggested that the Jews were entitled to possess the Holy Land. He just happened to be in contact with Hugh of Champagne and with Stephen Harding, who was a collaborator of Bernard of Clairvaux, the patron saint of the Templars. So why this is important is because the Crusades were a very enigmatic mission. The Muslims at the time controlled a massive area that spanned across North Africa and into Spain. And so instead of fighting the near enemy, you know, by beginning a struggle in Spain, the Crusades chose to cross all the way, you know, practically the other side of the world, and to try to seize Jerusalem, which doesn't really make any political or military sense. So I believe that it was entirely it wasn't a political mission. It was a mission of another kind, because I believe what happened is that it was long known that there were treasures buried beneath the site of the temple in Jerusalem that had been put there prior to the Roman conquest, and that the Jews had lost access to them. So somebody like Rashi would probably have been aware of that tradition and would have communicated to people involved in the founding of the Templars, which is what would have likely motivated them to, first of all, carry out the expedition, but then as well the excavations. So it's been proven that the Templars had conducted expeditions beneath the temple. And I believe what they did is they discovered the Sefer HaBahir, which is an ancient text, because according to the accounts, the Bahir showed up in Germany, first of all, as bits of tattered scrolls before it was then transmitted to southern France, where it was eventually compiled and written out. And it's the book that gave birth to the Kabbalah. And so that same Kabbalist tradition is basically what influenced sects like the Cathars, who were a Luciferian cult that was interconnected with the Templars, but also contributed to the legends of the Holy Grail. So even somebody like Wolfram von Eschenbach indirectly admits that his the legends that he was communicating were transmitted to him by Spanish Kabbalists. So that brings us back to the story of the Tannhäuser, which is the opera that so impressed Herzl and Hitler. So again, it's about a song contest where Wolfram produced this legend of the Night Swan, commemorating the spirit origins of Godfrey of Bouillon. Hermann the First's daughter-in-law was Elizabeth of Hungary, and she is known to have performed what's called the Miracle of the Roses. And this is now where you find the beginnings of twin traditions that came out of her influence, and one of them is the Order of the Dragon, and the other one is the Wars of the Roses. And the rose, as I've mentioned several times, is mentioned in the first lines of the Zohar, because the most important Kabbalist text for Kabbalistic interpretation is the Song of Solomon, or what's called the Song of Songs. It's a dialogue between the God and his beloved, quote unquote. And she begins by saying that, it begins by explaining, because there's a reference to the Rose of Sharon in the Song of Songs. And so the Zohar explains that the rose is a symbol of the Jewish congregation, along with the lily, which of course are the most well-known heraldic symbols of European aristocracy, particularly the families involved in the preservation of the occult. So here's where I'll try to make the story short. But basically, Elizabeth of Hungary is the ancestress of the Landgraves of Hesse. The most important one is Philip I, Landgrave of Hesse, who was one of the primary leaders in promoting the mission of Martin Luther, who adopted the rose as his seal. And he translated he made a German translation of the New Testament while at his time at Wartburg Castle, which was the site of the Tannhäuser song contest. Philip I and his network of Saxon aristocrats, who were all involved in promoting the mission of Martin Luther, it was their two generations later, their grandchildren, who were responsible for the creation of the Rosicrucian movement, which again adopted the rose of Martin Luther. So there you have, basically, in short, the story of the emergence of the Rosicrucian movement, which laid the groundwork for the emergence of Freemasonry, and the centrality of the legend of the Night Swan, which for some inexplicable reason was much admired by Theodor Herzl.
What about Zionism from that point? I mean, obviously, you've explained some of the links back then with the ideas of this Jewish homeland in the Holy Land, the claim on the real estate, if you want. Right. But what about its development and its production into action? I mean, surely this is one of the most fascinating tales is how, you know, we can't really talk about this without mentioning the Rothschild family, can we?
No. So this is why it's so peculiar that the single Tannhäuser opera and Richard Wagner was so influential on both Hitler and Herzl, who are supposed to be a diametrically opposed poets of this contest. So because the Rosicrucian movement was responsible for effectively giving purpose to the mission of Shabtai Zvi, who denounced his messiahship in 1666 to coincide with the number of the beasts from the book of Revelation, and which was also a date that was predicted by the Rosicrucians. So the next important successor of Shabtai Zvi was Jacob Frank. And so this is where the Rothschilds enter, because the Rothschilds basically had converted to, or members, important members of the family had converted to Frankism. So now where they sort of congregated, or his followers congregated, would have been an order called Asiatic Brethren, which was founded by his cousin, whose name was Moses Dobrushka. And one of his grand masters was Prince Charles of Hessen-Kassel, who was a descendant of the House of Hessen-Kassel, who again were descended from Philip I of Hesse and Elizabeth of Hungary, of the Miracle of the Roses. So the Hessen-Kassel family basically features prominently throughout this occult tradition. From the founding of Rosicrucianism, Prince Charles was also a member of the Illuminati and then becomes Grand Master of the Asiatic Brethren. And they also, so members of the Asiatic Brethren were also responsible for the formation of the, what's called the Frankfurt Judenlodge. It's called a Nodge, the full German name, I think, is Morgan Rota, is Nodge of the Nascent Dawn or something like that. There's not an accident that the Golden Dawn is a similar name, because the Golden Dawn was a deliberate revival of the Frankfurt Judenlodge. And so the leading personality behind this network was Moses Mendelssohn. So Moses Mendelssohn exercised an influence in a couple of important directions. Basically, you can trace almost all of modern Judaism back to him. This is where we get the bifurcation of the shift away from traditional Judaism, the Judaism of the Talmud, because we have to remember that the Frankists and Sabbateans rejected the Talmud in favor of the Zohar. And so what Moses Mendelssohn is considered the founder of what's called the Haskalah, which is the Jewish Enlightenment, or the Jewish version of the Enlightenment. And so he's the one who basically incepted the growth of Jewish emancipation. So how we're familiar with our interaction with Jews today is largely attributable to the influence of Moses Mendelssohn, because before his time, Jews used to live separated into ghettos, and they followed their own rules and culture, their own religious traditions, their own dress, their own customs, and so on and so forth. And there was a lot of restrictions, but in some ways, the Jews welcomed the segregation. Moses Mendelssohn proposed that Jews needed to get out of the ghetto, as the term goes, and to assimilate themselves into European culture. So that's why we have, in our time, the Jews would basically participate very much along the lines of, most other communities in the larger community, Western communities. But this is also because it was a reinterpretation of the meaning of what Jewishness meant. Prior to that point, to be Jewish meant to be a follower of the religion of Judaism. But once the Sabbateans removed the belief in the religion, then what was left was Judaism as an ethnicity. And this is why we get the beginning of not only Zionism, but of Nazism as well. So Nazism, it's important to remember that Nazism is basically composed of two key ideas. One of them is the notion of an Aryan race, and the other one is the idea of a folk. So the folk idea, so Moses Mendelssohn was a friend, influence of most of the key leaders of the Illuminati. Key amongst them was Friedrich Nicolai, who was the main publisher of the Illuminati. And what's interesting is Rabbi Entelman, who wrote the To Eliminate the Opiate, a book about the how the Sabbatean Frankists effectively hijacked Judaism. He discovered in his research in a list in a library in New York, I can't remember the exact name, it's like a Schiff library, Library of Jacob Schiff in New York. He discovered a list of ordination that listed all the purported successors of Sabbatai Zvi, and that Moses Mendelssohn was listed as one of the successors. And this was a list that had been preserved by Nicolai. He was friends with entire network of Illuminati, including Lessing and we'll come back to that in a minute. So and another one was Gottfried Herder. And Gottfried Herder is the one who coined the idea of the folk. And the idea of the folk was that the virtue, I guess you could say, of any nation was to be found in its language. And so this is how the German language in particular got identified as being sort of the essence of the Jewish folk. And so this idea of language now influenced the study of languages, because at the turn, at the end of the 1700s, excuse me, when the British established the East India Company, they discovered the language of Sanskrit. And as they began to study it, they recognized what they believed were similarities between Sanskrit and European languages. So they developed a theory that there must have been a single language that preceded it, and they called it hypothetically Indo-European. And it was Friedrich Schlegel, who was married to Dorothea, the daughter of Moses Mendelssohn, who proposed, instead of Indo-European, to use the word Aryan. And then when you look at the theory of Aryan race, you already find that already at this time, they're not overt in making the identifications, but they plant enough clues to show that they believe that the Aryans were descendants of the sons of God of the Bible, who survived the flood and then eventually became the Canaanites and ultimately the lost tribes of Israel. So this is how it goes back to the importance of the Canaanites that I mentioned earlier. This is an idea that is derived from the Zohar, because according to Zohar, there's the Bible refers to a group of people known as the mixed multitude, but the Zohar gives a particular importance to them as being a people who are refers to a number of identities, and they connect them again to the sons of God, to the Anakim, to the Nephilim, to the Canaanites, and so on, as being supposedly a people who had a corruptive tendency within the Jewish community. But this is to be interpreted in a Gnostic way, because in reality, these are the people who were supposedly the inheritors of the so-called ancient wisdom, which in fact is the Kabbalah. So basically, the whole idea of an Aryan race was a Kabbalistic idea based on the racism of the Kabbalah. There's an excellent book out by, Shahak is one of his names, the two Israeli historians that wrote a recent book about Zionism called Jewish Fundamentalism. And they show how there's a problem that it's a topic that scholars outside of Israel avoid, and that you can only find it when studying Israeli scholars of the Kabbalah about the racist core of the Kabbalah, because effectively the Kabbalah teaches that that as God's chosen people, only the Jews effectively are human. They carry, you know, there's some indications of this already in the Talmud, but the traditionally in Judaism, if a non-Jew converted to Judaism, he was considered a Jew, whereas in the Kabbalah, it's impossible that only Jews are effectively humans and that non-Jews are effectively devils. So this is how you see
that. Hardwiring racism in there.
Yes.
So, David, just pause for a second.
Yeah.
We're getting some pinging noises in the background. I don't know if you can find out what that is and switch it off somehow.
I'm not sure what went off, but it should be the last of it.
Oh, okay, great. Can I ask you then to bring it up to date a little bit?
Yeah,
with this whole concept of what is driving the Zionist cause right now. I mean, you know, obviously from anyone looking at this from the outside, there is a genocide going on, and yet you've got millions of people around the world, but particularly within Israel itself, who do believe that they are threatened, that actually their mission from God is under threat, and that they really have to fight back in a very extreme fashion against these people of a different race around them. So can you explain how Zionists manage to justify this to themselves? Because if you're looking at it from the outside, it looks absurd, it looks wicked, it looks absolutely unpalatable and evil.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, the biggest con that the Zionists have pulled off is that they somehow represent the Jewish community as a totality. And They are a heresy that have managed to gain control over only over the last couple hundred years, and to a large extent with some substantial help from the Rothschilds. If you look at the history of Zionism, the Rothschilds are there every step of the way. Even the Balfour Declaration itself was written and dedicated, well, written to Lord Walter Rothschild. So it's basically, you know, a combination of the extraordinary wealth building power of interest banking that put substantial funds at their disposal, and they use those funds to advance the voices, put forward, give prominence to the voices of these heretics, particularly the Sabbateans, because it's also the followers of Moses Mendelssohn who were involved in, again, the Frankfurt Judenlodge, who created two modern branches of Judaism, in fact, three modern branches of Judaism. There's Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, and Neo-Orthodox Judaism. And so this is how now Jewish tradition has been estranged from its true orthodoxy. And but really, if you look at the state of Israel, it's really just it's the ability of the Zionists to disguise themselves as somehow a legitimate element of the community to be able to and to have exercise enough political power so that they could basically seize seize the forefront of the Jewish community. But you know, this is what to go back to the point. So I try to make it short because there's a lot more detail I could go into, but I try to make it brief. But basically, so out of Moses Mendelssohn, you've got this twin track, and you've got one which is the development of Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism through his influence, and the other one is German nationalism, and that happens through his influence through various members of the Illuminati, like I said, Friedrich Schlegel and Gottfried Herder. And the another one is Gottlieb Fichte. There's a whole other series of members of the Illuminati that he had an important influence on, like Schelling and Schiller. Basically, the entire list, most of the people who were the founding figures of what's called Weimar Classicism and the German Romantic movement. And what's important is that this movement was sponsored by Karl August of Saxe-Weimar-Eisenach, who, because Eisenach, the city town of Eisenach, is the location of Wartburg Castle, and he could trace his descent back to the Knight Swan. So according to last name, Richard Houston Chamberlain, who was the Wagner's son-in-law, and one of the most important promoters of his racist ideas, or expanded on his racist ideas, was said that Richard Wagner's mother was actually the daughter of Carl August's brother, meaning that Wagner himself could claim descent from the Knight Swan. And Wagner is an important character because Wagner is really the key person who gave the most inspiration to the German nationalistic movement, and why he was so important to Hitler, but also paradoxically to Herzl. So, but Richard Wagner was born in the Jewish neighborhood of Leipzig. His real father, well, it turns out he knew himself, and this is what Nietzsche accused him of, is that his real father was Jewish. If you look at the entire network of Wagner's friends, they all belong to either the Asiatic Brethren or linked to it, or they are members of the Frankfurt Judenlodge. One of Wagner's important early operas was Rienzi. That's the opera that most influenced Hitler. It's based, first of all, the person who helped him put it together was a guy named Giacomo Meyerbeer, whose father was one of the founders of the Hamburg Temple, which gave birth to the founded by Israel Jacobson and a disciple of Moses Mendelssohn, which gave birth to the Jewish Reform Movement. And the Hamburg Temple is central to the Jewish Reform Movement. It's how it's from there that those traditions were imported in the United States. So this Meyer beer was just one of a entire network of basically crypto Frankists who were associated with the Asiatic Branding and Frank Reunion Lodge that were associated around Wagner. Like I said, Rienzi was based on a novel written by Edward Bulwer Lytton, who was initiated into the Frankfurt Juden Lodge and then became the central figure of the occult revival. There's two principal influences behind the Nazi movement, and that's Edward Bulwer Lytton and Helena Blavatsky, who basically created the sort of modern mythologized version of the Aryan race. And it was Bulwer Lytton's novel, The Coming Race, and the idea of a Vril, which inspired the Nazis and, of course, the founding of what's supposedly the Vril Society and the Thule Society. And it was that movement that Bulwer Lytton gave birth to, which eventually evolved in the creation of the Golden Dawn. To make another shortcut, because we're not going to be able to talk about all these points together, but Bram Stoker, who was a member of the Golden Dawn, was the author of Dracula. Bram Stoker's main consultant on vampire culture, which he resorted to write Dracula, was I think his name is Junius van Berry, who was a friend of Theodor Herzl. When Herzl was going around trying to arrange meetings with people like the Sultan of Turkey, it was van Berry who was arranging it. That's a whole other topic we can go into. But basically, Wagner, what you see now is coming out of this Weimar network of German romantics and people like Schlegel all around, around Moses Mendelssohn, like Schlegel and Herder, which gave birth to the elements that gave rise to German nationalism. It started to evolve over the entire length of the 19th century. And at a certain point, this is where Wagner enters into the scene, and he plants in a very important element and really begins the sort of focus on anti-Semitism. But because now you're looking at what happens, is this is around the same time that the idea of even the term itself, anti-Semitism, is introduced. Because until that point, until 1880, there was because it was that year that there was a famous anti-Semitic petition that was written, which was based on the idea, which rejected the idea that Jews could be identified as a religion and that they should be identified as a race. But when you look at the participants in that petition, most of them were linked to the Frankists, because at the core, the Frankists are anti-Jewish. From the beginning, they rejected the Talmud, again, I said, in favor of the Zohar, and they practiced a religion which was basically heavily opposed to Orthodox tradition. So they are effectively, is a civil war within the Jewish movement, and so they were out to sideline Orthodox Judaism, and they managed to gain prominence, again, I said, through the financial support of the Rothschilds. So when you look in, that's why when you look in, what you're seeing is that basically there's parallel traditions out of the same origin from Moses Mendelssohn and the Frankists. One trajectory ended up through Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, into Zionism, and the other one through people like Wagner, Edward Bulwer Lytton, and Blavatsky to the Nazis. And that's how these two elements sort of played into each other, because Zionism effectively is dependent on anti-Semitism.
Well, it sounds to me like they're controlling both sides of the chessboard.
It seems to be the case, yes.
Right. Look, one of the other things that's very interesting about Judaism generally, and it's difficult to get away from this one, is that Christianity embraces Jesus Christ from 2,000 years ago as the Messiah. But the Orthodox Jews, in fact, you know, one of the key things about the religious aspect of it is that they're still awaiting the Messiah.
Yes.
And so, I mean, this is something I remember reading from Dennis Wheatley years ago about the way that many British leaders and war strategists in the Second World War like to think of Hitler as this kind of man god that was a messiah for the German people, for this mythology that had been cooked up in the beginning part of the 20th century about the German race, the master race, this kind of thing. And this was a sort of precursor and a kind of test bed for a future messiah. But anyway, what do you make of this this idea that in pretty much all of these Jewish traditions expect the coming messiah? The Christians obviously expect something different, which is the return of Christ, but the Jews they're still waiting for this messiah.
So there's a couple of central elements to Jewish eschatology. And so one of them is the arrival of the Messiah, the rebuilding of the third temple, the return to Israel and the building of the third temple, and the return of the lost tribes to assist the Messiah in his conquest of the world. So, of course, there's different interpretations of that. There's the Orthodox Jewish interpretations of that, and then there's Kabbalistic ones. And so... what happens is that, like I said, there's this other parallel tradition of the sort of Aryan occult tradition, culminates in the founding of the Thule Society by Rudolf von Sebettendorf, who before founding this order was studying Kabbalah with a Jewish family in a Sabbatian Jewish family in Turkey, and then comes back to Germany and creates the Thule Society with this mythology about the Aryan race originating in Thule, which is effectively another name for Atlantis. And so what's strange is that it is Eric Ludendorff, who eventually became a friend with Aleister Crowley, who asked the head of the Reichswehr, which would have been the German secret police, to hire Hitler and ask him to infiltrate the German Workers' Party. The German Workers' Party was created by the Thule Society. And so what happens is that within months of joining the German Workers' Party, they are all mesmerized by his speaking abilities. And so this, what happens earlier than that is that Hitler in World War, the end of World War II, at the end of World War I, he was hospitalized for what's called hysterical blindness, which is basically a sort of like a psychosomatic blindness. And it's then that he begins his communication with what he called the voice. And so this voice the whole time guided him. So now the Thule Society, based on the ideas of Guido von List, expected that an Aryan Messiah was going to appear. So when they heard Hitler speak, presumably channeling this voice, they thought that he was the Messiah that List had prophesied. And, you know, this is what I discovered recently, is I'm really surprised to the extent, because there's really only one book which is seriously accepted as having discussed Hitler, the Nazism and the occult, and it's Nicholas Goodrich Clark's Roots of Occult Nazism, I think is what the title is. But you read the book and it's a complete whitewash, and just because he can't nail specific pronouncements on occultism by Hitler, he sort of dismisses a lot of the claims of occult influence when really everybody around him was immersed in the occult, including Rudolf Hess, Heinrich Himmler, and, you know, entire gamut of Haushofer and so on and so forth. Most of them were members of the Thule Society, and it's a well-known fact that the Nazi Party was an outgrowth or renaming, effectively, of the German Workers' Party, which was created by the Thule Society. Because what happens is that after gaining power, the Thule Society through the, it's called the Münchener Beobachter, which is the Munich Observer, which they took over, Sebettendorf bought it, and then it They changed its name to the Völkischer Beobachter, and it was operated by the Eheverlag, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And the Eheverlag, through the Eheverlag, the Nazis effectively managed to gain control of the vast majority. I think it was in 90% of the German press. And it's through the German press, because this is what really struck me with my recent research, is to what extent the Nazis had created a cult of personality. And that cult was externalization of the Thule belief that Hitler was the Messiah. And this is how they developed the idea of what's called the Führer Prinzip, which is the Führer principle. And the idea that Hitler was some kind of unquestionable guide. And this is how they effectively worshipped that as a Messiah, that every command he gave was to be, that's what the idea of the Führer Prinzip is. Every commandment he gave was to be accepted without question, because he was the Führer, and effectively the Messiah, who could not effectively see anything wrong. And so that's basically what transformed the German society and made them accomplish what they were able to do, is because it was the Thule Society working behind the scenes, preserving this crackpot as being, he's basically a failed, you know, twice a failed applicant to an art school, former male prostitute, lived in tenement houses, and then just because supposedly he's a loudmouth, that they, you know, believe this guy to be a messiah, and they actually gave them command of one of the most powerful states in the world. And again, based on the idea that he was some kind of strange Aryan messiah, which I would attribute to originally Kabbalistic influence, but because we have to not interpret him as the messiah in the conventional sense that we have, but in a sort of a Gnostic one, where he is a messiah of chaos, here to produce the sort of chaos necessary for accelerating the coming of the end times.
Finally, we've got to talk a bit about the way this is all expressing itself today, almost like this week. And we saw revelations about this artificial intelligence system that's being used by the Israeli Defense Forces. Mm-hmm. In order to target Palestinians. It's called Lavender. And effectively, anybody that, say, for example, has changed their address within the last 2 or 3 years is considered a suspect for elimination. And this whole thing is being done by computer. So the people who are actually sending out the drones to kill people are just literally clicking on a computer screen onto someone's name from a list generated by AI, David.
Yeah. But I think really what it comes down to is the bastardization of the concept of the chosen people, because that's really what the core is, right? The idea, again, the idea that they are chosen meant that it's like, if I choose you to assign you to look after my house while I'm away, doesn't mean that you can do whatever you want and make a wreck of it. I'm expecting that you're going to take good care of it. So when the Jews were chosen, the idea is that they were going to be caretakers of humanity. But again, they chose a shortcut, and they chose to believe that they are chosen irregardless of their actions. And this is how you get every possible bastardization that can come out of it, because they effectively believe that the ends justify the means. And if we understand this in a Gnostic sense, there's no action too awful that they can't do, that anything can be done if it's going to advance any degree of harm, especially because if the non-Jews are effectively not humans, they stand in the way of the fulfillment of God's prophecy, then they are to be expended with, and any means are justified. And that's the heresy of Zionism.
Yeah, it is a heresy for sure. The idea is interesting, isn't it? How this is just lies, really. I mean, the idea is that the world is worldly, the goyim, we can lie to them. Yeah. We can also lie to even to our own people about our true motives, because, like you say, the end justifies the means. I mean, this is a great departure from the teaching of the Ten Commandments, and maybe that's why they're not going to succeed in getting God's favor in their activities. Anyway, look, it's brilliant that you've taken the trouble to write this latest book. Can you just remind us of its title and how to get hold of it?
Thank you. So the title is Zionism, History of a Jewish Heresy. You'll find it on my website, which is ordoapkal.ca. That's where I keep most of my literature. My recent 6-volume book is entirely available online. You'll find a link in the main menu to my new Zionism book. You'll find a link to it, to the print and Kindle version on Amazon, as well as you can read the entire thing on the website.
And what's your outlook? Where do you think all this is going?
Well, I mean, it's the goal is to, in fact, here, I'll read you something else. It was explained by David Ben-Gurion, right? So he wrote in 1962, he said, in 1962, he expressed his vision for the world in 1987. So some of it's outdated, but you can see how what the ultimate goal is. He said, the image of the world in 1987 has traced in my imagination, The Cold War will be a thing of the past. Internal pressure on the constantly growing intelligentsia in Russia for more freedom and the pressure of the masses for raising their living standards may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the increasing influence of the workers and farmers and the rising political importance of men of science may transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. Western and Eastern Europe will become a federation of autonomous states, having a socialist and democratic regime, with the exception of the USSR as a federated Eurasian state. All the other continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished, and there will be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, in brackets, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents as prophesied by Isaiah. I hope that's as clear as I imagine it to be. So the point is, the goal is to fulfill Bible prophecy with a globe, because, you know, I took a course in Hebrew Bible at university, and unfortunately it was given, my professor was a Zionist, so he interpreted the entire Bible as being a story centered around the covenant. So the covenant of God's promise to the Jews and their chosenness. And after some back and forth, I finally asked him, I said, okay, so what's the point? He said, well, he said, someday the Messiah will come and the Jews will rule the world in peace. And so effectively, that's it. If you look at the fulfillment of the Jewish eschatology, it's very straightforward. The Messiah, basically, the Jews will be returned to Israel, the Palestine. They will rebuild the temple. I'm not sure what the order is, but they will receive the Messiah. They will rebuild the temple, and they will rule the world. So this is effectively the plan they're trying to put in place. And the United Nations, of course, has been a key element in helping to establish and reinforce the state of Israel. And effectively, like Ben-Gurion is saying, the world's going to be governed by a single world state with its capital in Jerusalem. And ideally, I guess what they imagine is ruled by their Messiah and with the help of some artificial intelligence.
Right. Well, look, it doesn't seem as if that's at all likely anymore. And it may be that that's just been used over the decades to garner support and get people on side. But it certainly doesn't look as if it's the one place right now that seems to be the least likely to be the center of a world government is Jerusalem, because of the example that the Zionists, the Israeli government, have been setting. Anyway, just finally, David, your website once more.
It's ordoapkal.ca.
Righto, David Livingstone. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Tony. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us.